Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi folks, we're back in the studio. I hope all of you are well rested following your respective fellow weeks and that you're ready to digest another busy week of Six Nations action. I'm Ben Coles, he's Charlie Morgan.
Colesy.
He's Charles Richardson.
Hello.
How were your fellow weeks? What did you do, Charlie?
Downtime, hard downtime, family time. Only rugby I watched was Celestino Ravutamada.
Is that
his name? Is that how you pronounce his name? Carving for Fiji and Drury, even though they lost. But
ask Charles, he'll tell you.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the backstory to that is that Charles thought he was terrible during that warm-up game between England and Fiji, and he carved up in that game as well.
Well, he was terrible for the first 15 minutes, and which I was sort of doing play ratings, and I'd written, oh, God, this guy's rubbish, bloody, bloody, blah. Properly chucked him under the bus, and then he had a worldie.
Mm. I mean, yeah, I was going to say, in your defence, it was early doors in that game. Charles, what did you do?
I was on the beach in Spain.
Of course you were.
I was on the beach in Spain.
Whereabouts?
Calpe, so Costa Blanca.
It's all right for some, isn't it?
Yeah.
Blimey.
I was eating lots of tapas.
Oh. Firing back pictures of said tapas.
Yeah.
It did look quite good. It did look very nice. Charlie, you chatted to a rugby influencer last week.
I did.
How was it?
I loved it. His video content made me pine to play again, which doesn't happen very often, but he really gets to the heart. Max Brown, he really gets to the heart of why the game's fantastic, why more people should be involved with grassroots clubs. He's brilliant. Rugby is in a bit of a vice and feeling probably pretty neurotic about not engaging Generation Z, and he is doing a fantastic job of that. I can reveal that within a few hours of that piece going live, a Premiership club were contacting Max Brown to potentially get him in to speak to their players about harnessing personalities on social media, which is fascinating and fantastic as well.
That's very interesting. Did you feel quite old?
I felt about 104.
Okay.
Max is 22. He's 12 years younger than me, but speaking a different language, but just aware of how the priorities have, how people consume content has changed. I wouldn't say, the main thrust of the point I was making in the piece is that rugby's assets, and what makes rugby so, what makes us fall in love with rugby, that is also making youngsters fall in love with rugby. It's just that when it is packaged maybe in a less apologetic way, which is what Max is doing.
Charles, you're basically the youth movement on this podcast. So you're all up to date on the trends and things like that. It's interesting, isn't it? I really enjoyed it. It's a good kind of insight into an area that you don't know a lot about.
Yeah, and we've touched on this before. We touched on this with the Netflix stuff and with the Six Nations documentary about how, you know, I believe, and I think it's a viewpoint that is shared by people who work with rugby day in, day out, that rugby needs to do more at developing and showing off the things that do make it great rather than trying to artificially create new qualities. It has sundry qualities as a sport. It's the reason why we all love it. It just needs to reconcile and find a way to sort of advertise those and market those in the best way for a new generation. And Gen Z, got to be Gen Z, surely.
Is that not you? Telegraph.
No, I know I'm a millennial, I believe.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I know, so I'm only just I'm only
late
just
millennial.
Waving the flag for
a late millennial.
A late millennial.
That sounds like an offshoot, like genre of music, which I'm not quite mastered yet. Mm. Fallow weeks, second Fallow week. I mean, Charles is obviously a massive fan because he's been swanning around in Spain. We talked on this before, didn't we? It's going to get cut eventually. So for people who are saying it's lost momentum, I mean, careful what you wish for, because at some point in a few years' time, we won't have this Fallow week.
I think it should be cut. I think it's the right thing. I think it has lost a bit of momentum, especially off the back of that France-Italy match, which was such a brilliant match that had everybody talking about it and was so dramatic and had and brought such fizz to the tournament, I think. And then that fizz has gone, and it's the champagne's a bit flat, or your respective sparkling wine of choice, whichever European region that you're in. But I think that it's a real error from the Premiership side to not have any rugby in the Fallow week. There was nothing on except for in England. You could watch URC, you could watch the top 14. I watched last night La Rochelle batter Clermont Auvergne. There was Super Rugby, but I think there should have been Premiership fixtures. I know that they don't want clashes with the Six Nations, and I understand that, but it's a Fallow week. There weren't Six Nations fixtures. At worst case, they should have had the Premiership Rugby Cup final last weekend.
I watched a bit of the Sevens. Couldn't tell you the last time I watched Sevens. And obviously, it's been a while because I told you what channel it was on, because I had to look for what channel it was on. I didn't realise it was on TNT. So that kind of shows where we are. Is it going to be this Fallow week, though? Or is it going to be the first Fallow week that they cut? As in, are they going to go three, break two? Or are they going to go two, break three?
I'm not sure.
Three, break two feels... more, I don't know.
I'd say you're limping to the end a little bit on that. But that's why the World Cup is so coveted, right? Because you've got to go back to back and have those, just have those, that block of seven games, and at the end of that, you know, a champion is crowned. And I just think, as an aside, with all of the narratives and how that stops with the two Fallow weeks, I just think it's a good idea.
We're going to be hearing from former England captain Will Carling a bit later in the podcast. So let's move on and dive into the section about England and just get an idea about what we can expect from them against Ireland this week. Okay, so the latest England squad update on Sunday night was kind of interesting. A minor detail was that Alex Mitchell and Marcus Smith are no longer rehabilitating their injuries. They're fully fit. They're fully available. Charlie, why have you just put your hands over your face?
Oh, just because of he...
I'm delivering a squad update.
Alex Mitchell has defied initial prognosis on his the injury. I reported that it was going to be a longer layoff than that, but it's a huge boost, isn't it?
It's a medical marvel.
His medical marvel. Got very flexible knee ligaments.
Never seen the like.
It's a big boost to have him back. He'd come from, as we know, fourth choice seemingly before the World Cup to make that position his own. Started the first couple of games. He brings that zip around the ruck. He brings that accurate distribution. Whether he's playing for Saints and we've seen brief glimpses of it for England, he really hammers home that when sides get quick ball, he makes that look a lot better because he's super, super fit. And he just brings that continuity. The contrast to that was, and it's probably quite tough to highlight this too much, but Danny Kerr starting at Murrayfield, Scotland got on top of that breakdown battle. They're really, really clever with the timing of their counter rucks, how strong they were there. Grant Gilchrist had a blinder watching the game back. Rory Darge was fantastic in with his post tackle actions, just holding up carriers for a little bit longer, and that messed up the cadence of England's phase play. And Danny Kerr had a really tough day as a result. So I think it's a big boost to have Alex Mitchell back there.
Charles, let's talk hypocrisy, because we bang on about how England need cohesion and they need, you know, to not chop and change and maybe kind of build a partnership. But actually, realistically, you could have Alex Mitchell and Marcus Smith at halfback for the first time in this championship if both are fit. I mean, you know, it's another change, but maybe this time it's the right one because this is what they wanted to do all along, supposedly, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I would bring Alex Mitchell straight back in, I think, just because he was sort of he has been Borthwick's starting scrum half since the World Cup when fit. I think I'd bring him straight back in, especially as Danny Kerr seemingly struggled starting at Murrayfield. The bench scrum half is the intriguing one. Do you revert Danny Kerr back to back to replacement nine, or do you have Ben Spencer coming back off the bench? I'm not sure. I mean, I think he would revert back to Danny Care back on the bench. I mean, I think I would probably want to give Ben Spencer another run. I don't think he did too much. There was that one grubber kick again at Murrayfield, but other than that, I don't think he really did too much wrong. And then Marcus Smith surely is nothing more than the bench this weekend, is he? I mean, would he hasn't played in such a while, and would he chuck him straight back in?
This is the debate, isn't it, though? Because technically everybody assumes because it's Ireland that you're kind of on a hiding to nothing anyway. So what are you really losing about just going with the combination that you wanted in the first place and bringing them both back in? I don't necessarily... If you thought that England were genuine title contenders and they were 3 from 3 and they'd, like, you know, romped Ivic in the three games, then of course you wouldn't tinker with a winning formula necessarily, apart from bringing Mitchell back because he was the starter.
Yeah.
I think, why not?
Yeah, but I think by that logic, you might go with Finn Smith. Smith, who impressed so much off the bench. I mean, I know he missed that sort of relatively straightforward conversion and dropped that high ball, which were blots on his copybook. But other than that, he looked really, really sharp off the bench. And he got one over Jack Crowley at Toman Park in the Heineken Cup with Northampton against Munster. And, you know, these are the little things that might matter. You know, Jack Crowley knows that he's been outplayed once by him. A second time, could it happen? I mean, I don't think it probably will, but I'm clutching at straws a little bit here.
I like it.
But, I mean, if you're going down the route of we're on a hiding to nothing, so let's take a bit of a risk and roll the dice a bit, then I think I'd start Finn over Marcus, and I think I'd have Marcus coming off the bench.
I'm looking at Charles while he's saying that. He's going, Jack Crowley's not going to care about that. I don't think he's on fire. This whole discussion just highlights to me how much of a catch-22 England's whole week is looking like. Selection's really, really tough. The one that really accentuates it to me is George Furbank. If he was brought in for the Scotland game because England had to score points, connect their back line, take opportunities against Scotland, guess what? They're going to have to do that to get anywhere near Ireland. And the last couple of times they've played Ireland, England have put them under pressure with, albeit having had guys sent off in all three games, I think the last three games they played Ireland, but in the last two Six Nations games, they've put Ireland under pressure with kick pressure, with a strong set piece, both scrum and line out, but there has still been an air of inevitability about how Ireland have pulled away from them at the end. And that says to me that they've got to keep trying to, as much as they are devoting time to the blitz defence and getting that right as a foundation of their game, which is, I think, fair enough. They've also got to push the boat out a little bit as far as how they move the ball. And I think bringing in Furbank for one game, taking him away from the other, just looks muddled. And Steve Borthwick's calling card when he came in was clarity, wasn't it? And I just think that would not, that would jar.
What's the catch? The catch 22 here is, I mean, what would we prefer? What would England fans prefer? What would the management prefer? Is it genuinely start Marler and Cole again, Stewart comes back in, go semi-final against South Africa, try and eke out a narrow victory, kicking your goals?
I think people would prefer if England attacked and died trying.
Yeah, so lose by 14 points but score 3 tries. Would that be preferable? I mean, I'm sort of, you know, I'm not sure. Is winning everything in this game? I mean,
what do you think aggregate scoreline of line breaks is in the last two Six Nations games between England and Ireland?
Wouldn't shock me if it was more even than people think. Ireland will just use. Is it? Oh, it's is it miles?
No, I was going to go the opposite. Is it miles? It was a landslide.
It's England,
is it ridiculous?
England 2.
A 2.
Ireland 18.
Oh my god.
Yeah,
and I was there in Dublin, so I don't know why that staggers
that
me.
Is 2 14-man defensive efforts, in fairness. But even so,
still there.
Yeah, I know, even so. Because what we have said before is, and I think we said it last week, was that England have always sort of upped their game against Ireland in these past two. If we discount that World Cup warm-up where it was, you know, where he was building, Steve Borthwick was building for the tournament, last year until Freddie Stewart's ridiculous red card in the Six Nations last year, England had Ireland rattled for a bit, and even after Charlie Ewells was sent off in that game at Twickenham, it wasn't a foregone conclusion until maybe the 65th, 70th minute when England ran out of steam a bit. They did have them rattled, and I just wonder, and they weren't sort of playing this all-court expansive rugby then, and I do wonder whether they feel like they can get into into Ireland at some of the sort of building blocks and the foundations a little bit, because Ireland are going to be more fluid. They have got more of a flourish. They have got more of a cherry and icing on the cake. Like, we all know that. Maybe trying to stop that or trying to match that with a two-week preparation period could be folly. It might be. I don't know. Would you not prefer? Would England fans genuinely prefer a 14-point loss and scoring three beautiful tries, or would they prefer a 18-15 victory at Twickenham with six penalties?
I mean, it's not a great choice, is it? I mean, should really reference at this point a story from Dan Schofield in the Telegraph over the weekend about England's kind of lack of time on the attack, and that one England player only had one England back, sorry, only had one touch during a training session. I think we said last week, one of us said last week, surely they're just focusing on the defence and the attack is going to come later, because otherwise how do you explain it, kind of thing. And that kind of chimes to that a bit, doesn't it?
At some point, though, it needs to come, doesn't it? That's what we said last week.
I wonder if it'll even be, I don't think it'll be until the summer or the autumn, was my kind of thinking. Sorry,
Elliot Butlin, a friend of the pod, got in touch with me to raise the point that we have this issue of timelines with England and with Steve Borthwick, in that they prioritised experience for the World Cup and saw the World Cup as this standalone event, did really well at it. But then our fans now thinking, well, Steve Borthwick has had a year with the team, so they should be further along. Meanwhile, Steve Borthwick is viewing the post-World Cup as a separate entity, whereby they've gone back to defence as a foundation and they're building everything from that. That is where friction is coming, in my opinion.
The odds, by the way, I've just had a look. England 4-1, 4-1 at home at Twickenham against Ireland. I mean, goodness me. I think that sums up the state of the two teams. It actually seems quite fair, doesn't it?
And also maybe worth a tenner.
I mean, I didn't.
If you're willing to lose a tenner,
I didn't say that. Charles said that. Let's hear from Will Colling now and see what he thinks.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, everybody. Apologies for the background noise from this chat coming up with Will Carling in a restaurant in London today, but we discussed plenty about England. Jamie George's kind of role as a leader within the side, when Carling was a mentor under Eddie Jones, lots of topics about the modern game with physicality and eligibility, and also what he makes of England's style of play. Hope you enjoy. Thank you for joining us on the Telegraph Rugby Podcast, Will Carling. How are you?
I'm very good. You?
I'm not so bad. Not so bad. We're nearing the end of the Six Nations. Who's winning it? Come on then. Put you on the spot. Straight in there.
I'd love to say that we will somehow... I said we, England, but... Ireland are looking very, very, very impressive. So it's hard to look past them, really.
It's the consistency, isn't it, and the way they seem to have very effective systems in place.
Yeah, they really understand how they're trying to attack. They really understand how they're defending. It's impressive. And hey, that's a massive advantage when you've got 10 of them from one province, isn't it? Week in, week out, you're able to play and train together. So their understanding, I think, as a group is exceptional.
Can I ask you, plenty of people to ask about, but with sort of England and Twickenham, we talk a lot at the moment about Twickenham atmosphere and regenerating that, and I know they've gone to great pains to try and liven that up in recent weeks. What do you sort of make of that, I guess?
First and foremost, you know, you've got to win your games. You know, that's what people want to watch, and I think that's the focus. But I think it's, and I think the crowd generally are smart enough to watch. They want to see a team playing it and using its ability, I think, and using the potential that it has, rather than, I think the frustration of late has been that it's been quite a formatted, almost constricted game, that you just get a sense that it's, you know, the players, personally, I think the players have got more ability and potential than we're seeing at the moment, and I think that's the sense that you get the feeling in the crowd, that's what they feel as well. It's almost like they're playing within a straight, you know, they're being confined to play a certain way, and I think there's a frustration with that.
Is that a developmental thing based on where England are in their cycle, or is there more to it?
Well, when we say where they are, you know, as in, you know, also what interests me when I hear quotes of, you know, we're a young team. Well, we're not, actually. If you look at who's being selected, we're a very experienced, you know, you've got the Mungallas, Coles, Danny Cares, George Fords. We've got a lot of very old, experienced players. So I wouldn't say we're a young developing team. We've probably got quite a few young developing players on the bench, but, you know, there's a big difference between who's starting and who's on the bench. So I don't think it's a development thing. I think it's just it's what this coaching team believes is the way to win rugby matches, which is primarily driven by what they see in data. You know, and for me, it's opinions, isn't it? My view in terms, I'm sure data gives you insights into, you know, games, but it's rather like, if you're looking at data in hindsight on games, you can be reading stuff into that, and actually you can end up reading it in the wrong way. Whereas I think sport is about taking risks, is about fulfilling potential, it's about the ability, watching players do things that make you, you know, get up off your seat. You know, it's about certain times taking risks. There's space, you know, suddenly there's, you know, there's overlap, you're in your 22, well, let's go, let's play. And I think where the frustration at the moment is, I sense that England are very much having to play a format, like they're in a data straitjacket, is what I call it. Like, it's frustrating. I'm sure for players as well as fans, it's now I might be biased. I think we have players with more potential than that, more ability than that. But hey, do you know what? And the real truth is, but it's so bloody easy when you're sitting in the stand.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm very aware of that. You sit there and you go, oh, why don't we do? I was like, Christ, as long ago as when I was playing, we used to get criticised the whole time for being boring. It's funny, isn't it? And people now go, oh, Will, it was great. And you go, well, actually, we were criticised for being boring in my day. But it's like, so things change and it's never going to be perfect.
It would be remiss of me to not, given we always seem to chat about England's midfield on a daily basis, maybe a weekly basis. You and Jerry had so much time as a partnership together, didn't you? I mean, how many games alongside each other?
Against me, I mean, gone late 40s, probably.
Yeah. Whereas, obviously, not necessarily through England's fault, but there's a lot of, because there were a lot of chopping and changing with combinations and partnerships. Do you sort of have an idea of what the right combo is, the right balance is, or?
Well, I think that's one of the arts of being
the head coach or whatever is, when I look back, Christ, all the way back when I started, you know, what I think Jeff Cook, and I've always said never gets anywhere near enough credit, was he made a few crucial calls of, I need to make a call over Stuart Barnes or Rob Andra. You know, it's like, I need to make a few other key calls. As much as I can, I will keep combinations together and give them time. And Clive did that, you know, and at test level, that split second is worth so much. And I think Eddie tinkered way too much towards the end of his time. And I think, sadly, yeah, we're still suffering from that. And I think a head coach has to have a look at it and go, right, in essence, this is my front row, this is my back row, this is my, you know, this is my midfield. It's sort of, and you've got to give them time. And there's a lot of change with England at the moment. And I think it's very hard to play test rugby when you've played 1, 2, 3 games together. Jerry was lucky to have played alongside me as often as he did. He knows that.
You worked like a mentoring role during Eddie's time.
Yeah.
Can you sort of explain how that would work and what you'd do?
So it was just trying to help the sort of the leadership team have a think about how they wanted to lead, what sort of environment they wanted to create, what was important to them.
So would that be Owen Farrell? Yeah. Jamie George?
No, Jamie actually, bizarrely, and I had a few arguments with Eddie over it, was never in the leadership team. Courtney was, there was a variety of people. You know, Owen obviously was, Courtney, but it, yeah, there was a bit of change, but I think it's so different in terms of age, their perspective on life, their life experience, because they from academies that they've just been in rugby, so they're not really asked to lead, take on responsibility, you know, to challenge, to think, to question at clubs. There are not many clubs or coaches who want to be challenged, question, you know, whereas for me, I think that's a basic element of leadership and learning how to lead. And if you are like Jamie, if you're made England captain, then you've got to think long and hard about why did you say yes to Captain England? Why did you say yes to being part of the leadership group? Because you want to try and help that group achieve their potential. And sometimes that means challenging coaches. That means challenging each other. And that's not a skill set that I think is encouraged much in academies or clubs or England, even.
Did you really get along with most things when you were in that role? Or is that just one example?
I think he did. I mean, I think Eddie's view, you know, was great. And yet you always knew that his real belief was that fitness and functional playing roles, he viewed, get those right and you win games, not leadership, environment, sense of family, identity, purpose. Now, mate, you know, so I had a slight difference of opinion on what I think ultimately really makes a successful team, but hey, he was in charge.
But I can see the value there of having you in that setup to sort of give him another viewpoint.
And we had a few stand-up arguments, it would be safe to say. So, but hey, that's the way it should be.
You obviously would have grown quite close to Owen during that time, and he's no longer England captain. He's no longer in the squad. His move to France is now confirmed. I just wonder what you make of it all.
I think it's very sad if that is the end of his England career, that's the way it finished. He is a very proud, passionate England rugby player and a very, very, very good one. And I know there was a lot of
common in the media, on social media, you know, and a lot of it is not complimentary. And I think, sadly, my view on it, a huge amount of that frustration that was aimed at him was a frustration in the way England were playing and what they were delivering on the pitch, and that actually was not his call.
Is there a perception thing there as well? When you're England captain, people have a perception of Owen, don't they, based on what they're seeing.
I think we all do. You know, it's weird. Like going a tangent. I had a perception of, and you'd think you'd learn, having been on the receiving end. I had a perception of Finn Russell.
Okay.
You know, and I watched the first episode of Full Contact, and I'm like, I like him, which was really hard to admit. But I do. He was a great character, and I think that's the weird bit. Most people, you see someone on a pitch performing, doing what they're doing, and that is very different from the person that they are. And I think it's the same with Owen, and the same with Owen. Say, he's not someone who's going to talk freely in front of the media. He's not going to be relaxed at a press conference. He's not going to let you in and understand how he feels about family, and just not the nature of the man. So yeah, as you say, there's a perception of what he is, which is very different from what he is, and that's a sadness. But that is sport. That's being in the public eye. That's part of it, and it is very hard to deal with. But if you hold your hand up, you've got to deal with it.
With that, just think about Jamie. I think everybody admires him a lot as a captain anyway. I think before Scotland last week, given the loss of his mum and how he sort of went through that, that would have only increased admiration for him. And I imagine that's the case with you as well, when you think about him as a leader and a captain.
Yeah, I think it must have been incredibly hard for him, and it was very brave of him. I've always, you know, as I said, I had quite a few arguments with Eddie about getting him onto the leadership group. He is the biggest challenge, I think, for England at the moment is to be having the honest, uncomfortable conversations that you need to as a team when you're trying to learn and trying to improve, and it's getting the balance of having those as well as building confidence. You know, I think Jamie is very aware. He's got great emotional intelligence, and hopefully he'll be getting that balance right.
When Jeff Cook made you captain, you were 22. England were in a period of kind of underachievement, might be the politest way to put it. I don't necessarily know who the equivalent would have been in this squad, in this group, or who it might have been. Is that another way they could have gone? Obviously, Jamie's 33.
It's unique. People go, oh, well, you were 22 and then things started to go really well. And I'm like, yeah. Bizarrely, you had characters like Dean Richards and Winterbottom and Teague, experience like Rob Andrew. So all you had to do as a youngster was actually get them talking and telling you what needed to change and happen. And in a way, I look at England at the moment. Have we got those experienced characters in the, possibly not, you see, or maybe we have. And I think the difference generationally, the difference is that in Mike, they had the confidence to talk and to have opinions, and they would challenge coaches, because it was a very different sort of time. I think now you have the issue of money, that actually playing for England makes a huge financial difference to players, right? Okay, for us it was a dream, but players had that, whether it was belief, confidence, that they would challenge, debate with coaches, argue with coaches. I think it's hugely difficult. And I haven't seen it within the way you create an environment where they feel confident enough to challenge and debate stuff without thinking it's going to affect selection and possibly, you know, money for them. And I think that's something that
you know, is just hugely understandable from the player's point of view.
Which is what you said recently about it perhaps potentially not being the pinnacle for some players, I guess.
Well, you know, you sort of think it is a career now for a player, right? And hence playing for England is a huge bonus financially in your career. Why would you jeopardise that by disagreeing with a coach? But ultimately, if you're coaching England, my view would be you want an environment where people can challenge and feel confident enough to challenge, and you can listen and take on board thoughts, and eventually, of course, you agree. You're in charge of the ultimate direction. But I think it's something that maybe England haven't cracked as well as they could have done in the time that I watched it.
Will, thanks very much for your time.
Pleasure.
Okay, as for the other games this weekend, Charles, you are going to go from Twickenham on Saturday down to Cardiff on Sunday for a game which, let's be honest, at the start of the tournament, I think we just thought France would win by 18 to 20 points and you'd have a nice easy afternoon. Now, Wales against France is a fascinating game, isn't it? Because you don't really know, I can't believe I'm saying this, I don't really know who's going to win.
No. France have an excellent record there under Galtier. But they do build it up as a sort of very difficult place to go. There is a sort of almost an England-Wales aspect to it, or an England going to a Murrayfield aspect to it for France. They're aware of how romantic a rugby location it is, with its prestige and its history and tradition, and they do really give it a lot of respect. And they're going to need to... Gregory Aldry hopefully coming back, which is a massive boost for them. But then Jalibert is out. It looks like they're going to move Thomas Ramos to fly half, where he's deputised quite a lot this season with Toulouse. And then they might start Leo Barre at fullback, the under 20 star, who is uncapped. And it looks like they might bring in Emmanuel Meafu as well, who is also uncapped. Huge. In the second row, who is gigantic. So we could be looking at a Pasolo Meafu second row combination, given that all three of their back rowers jump. In the line out.
How's your scrum?
With Weenie as well, with Weenie on the tight end.
Oh, man.
That's just, it's gargantuan, isn't it? What I would say is I do think this is about the first must-win game of Galtier's tenure, like absolute out-and-out must-win. I think if they lose in Cardiff, there's then a lot of pressure to beat England and Lyon when they're misfiring, frankly, and they certainly will have been misfiring if they lose in Cardiff. And if they lose those two, then he could be in real, real bother. So I think this is about... I wouldn't say it's the biggest game of Galtier's tenure, because they've obviously won a Grand Slam and they played the All Blacks in a World Cup opener and had a World Cup quarter-final. But I think it's the first pressure-on, must-win game of his tenure, where if he loses, then people are going to be asking serious questions.
Yeah, it's interesting. It was a Friday night game 2 years ago, wasn't it, when France were going for the slam. And I'm just looking at that Wales team, just looking at it now, it's so different. I think it just shows kind of the regeneration project that they're going through. Yeah, I mean, Liam Williams, Alex Cuthbert, Jonathan Davies, Dan Bigger, Faletau, Navidi, so many players that are gone from 2 years ago. I from watching Wales in Dublin, there were things to like, particularly, as we said last week, Cam Winnett at fullback, Wainwright at number eight, Tommy Raphael was amazing. The defence was good in that it limited Ireland, and then it kind of fell apart when Ireland found a way through it. This would be huge for Wales, wouldn't it, Charlie? If they could get a win here, because I don't really see they're sort of running. I mean, they've got that Italy game to finish off. If they could trouble France and win, that'd be astonishing.
Huge ahead of schedule. Really, in contrast to how and we're consumed by the obviously the stances on England because we cover it so closely. But the contrast is really interesting. Wales have lost 3 out of 3. England have won 2 out of 3. And the narrative that is building around those respective teams' tournaments is so different because of how Wales have, partly through circumstance, really lent into the a revolutionary sort of sense. England have gone where it's going to be steadily, and therefore there's less patience because of them. And I think with Wales need certainly, I think, need one win over the next two to sort of justify how Warren Gatland has gone about this. But I was speaking to, I did have a very small amount of rugby chat this weekend with an Ireland fan who was over, and he said, "Wales, you know, after watching last week, Wales is going to be good by the World Cup," and he was sort of steadfast in how in that sense of optimism. Now, it's always kind of different when it's a different nationality sort of looking in from the outside, and I'm sure Wales fans will still have their frustrations with how things are going. But yeah, absolutely, win would be huge. Win would justify everything that's gone on, I think, as far as selection and wiping that slate clean.
That's kind of it, isn't it, though? As in, I like that I like the patience, and I like the fact that people are recognising that they might be good in 4 years' time, because that we are, you know, I know we don't like talking about cycles. We are at the start of a four-year cycle where actually, if you're going to experiment and give it a go, why not do it now?
And it's out of necessity as well, yeah. As far as player pools, as far as the kind of upheaval at regional level. So there's that to factor in as well.
I'm going to say that Wales will play the better rugby in Cardiff, I think. I think France have looked really clunky and really inaccurate, but I think France will win. I think they'll have too much power. I don't like the Welsh front row struggled with the Irish scrum a lot from the off.
Well, they are going to have too much power if Mayafu and
Tuilagi.
Well,
and if it's Mayafu, Tuilagi and Antonio, it could be a proper demolition job up front. And I think France just might bully them in terms of the sort of power stakes and just limp to a narrow victory. But Wales will have played all the better rugby, I feel. If they can get parity at the set piece and at the maul, France's maulers look really good as well. In attack, not maul D, but their attacking maulers look decent when they can actually win a line out. If Wales can get parity at the set piece, then I think they've got a chance. But that's easier said than done, really. And there's only so much work you can do on that, I think, before it just becomes a sort of shootout between weight on, you know, mass. It's just one gargantuan mass is heavier than another, and it's physics.
Sorry, I thought you were going to say something else there where you start saying shit. And I got a bit excited. I was like, Charles, we can't say that on the pod. And related to that, while I'm thinking of it, I think France could obviously give Wales a bit of a nightmare for clean ball at the breakdown, given the presence of those heavy forwards. But if they can get something, there's been sort of flashes from George North and Rio Dyer in particular that they can be lively. I'd love to see Wales kind of try and expand on these little moments that they had in Dublin and actually get a bit more, get Dyer in particular into chances or looping off his wing. I think he's such an exciting player. Yeah, that game it's suddenly far more interesting than we thought it was going to be.
Mayafu, that's such an exciting, I can't remember too many more exciting debutants and debutants where you're just so assured that they're going to be a factor in a force in Test rugby, and Leo Barre is a highlight machine, right? Yeah. Lots of fun.
Is that because of his high placing in the top 100?
Mayafu?
Yeah.
Oh, well, we're bigging up our own work, marking our own homework. Yeah,
that's the whole reason we have a podcast, is to big up our own work.
I'd say partly, yeah.
He also ticks another box while I'm thinking about it in terms of big piece last week on eligibility and how the effect on that in the modern game. And Mayafu, Charles, you'll be able to tell me, could have qualified for Australia
and New Zealand,
I believe. And he's ended up with France. And, yeah. And I think actually France are very happy that he has done, based on what we've seen from him at Toulouse.
Should say as a bit of a disclaimer, though, that when I interviewed him, he does now see himself as French, as an adopted Frenchman, as a French citizen. He has a French passport. He went over to France to start his rugby journey again. Toulouse gave him a lifeline. And he was not going over there as a project player. That Mayafu's agent sent Toulouse a clip, and they thought, okay, we'll give you a trial. And he was a nobody at this point. And I think Mayafu feels indebted to Toulouse and to the French rugby sort of arena to repay some of that faith.
Yeah, that's a lovely story. Speaking of games which are now suddenly more interesting than we thought, Italy against Scotland in Rome. I will be there. I'm very intrigued to see whether Italy can build on that draw in Lille. And also, it's a great test for Scotland's composure, isn't it? I kind of think, you know, off the back of that England game, backing it up, this is the thing that we want to see from Scotland. We want to see consistency in performance. If they go out there and they, you know, score four tries and they're impressive in attack, I think that will kind of justify a lot of people's opinions about Scotland as a good team. It kind of reinforces that they're not flaky, and I think that is the word that currently they're trying to shake off, isn't it? What do you sort of see happening?
I think if they limp to victory against Italy, then I think we can rule out a championship decider in Dublin. I think if they've got serious designs, if they've got grand designs on going to Dublin and upsetting the apple cart and potentially thwarting an Irish Grand Slam, I think they need to really put Italy to the sword. They need to be ruthless. They need to play very well. Just because they're going to need that confidence. It's a place where they haven't had, you know, when was the last time we mentioned this? When was the last time that Scotland last won in Dublin? It was yonks ago, but I can't remember the exact.
So long.
Well, with that sort of record, you need wind in your sails. And I think if they're really troubled by Italy this week, despite the strides that Italy have made, I think if they're seriously troubled by Italy this weekend, God forbid, don't even win, then I think they can kiss goodbye any hopes of lifting that title.
There's that narrative of Scotland flattering to see, but also Italy as well. Like, how good would it be to see them build on that? Because they had such promising moments against England before sort of falling flat for the second half of that game, and then carrying that sort of subdued mindset seemingly into the Ireland game. And then it's great that they picked themselves up with that battling performance against France. And it would be really, really good if they continued that at home to Scotland and actually and troubled them. It's going to be, it's one of those games that it's a cool matchup, isn't it? It's likely to be fast paced. It's likely to be expansive. Let's hope it delivers.
Yeah, Scotland got 5 tries when they went to Rome 2 years ago. Italy haven't actually beaten Scotland for quite a while. 2015 Six Nations is the last time. I think we think of it as quite a, maybe more even than that, but Scotland are actually on a bit of a tear against them.
I mean, last year the scoreline flattered Scotland. I can't remember the exact final score, but it certainly flattered Scotland, because if you remember, Italy were camped on the Scotland line with basically clocking almost in the red for, they were there for sort of 5 minutes or so, 5 metres out, looking for the try to win, and then they coughed up the ball and Scotland went the length, didn't they, to score a try and conversion to seal it. So it actually made it look like there was more than one score in it when there really wasn't. And Italy pushed them really close last year. I don't think there was anything actually riding on that game, though, except for Italy avoiding the wooden spoon, I suppose. Whereas this year, you know, there is something really for Scotland. They obviously need to hope that England do them a favour at Twickenham. But if they went to Dublin and won, they wouldn't even need a favour from. They might not even need a favour at Twickenham.
It's the classic coach speak game, isn't it? Don't take your eye off the ball and think about the game next week in Dublin. Go to Rome and get the job done. Particularly excited to see. Well, I think that's what I like about Scotland in general. There's just players that now you actually want to see play. I don't expect Duane van der Merwe to get another hat-trick, but I'm intrigued to see, you know, what he can do in Rome. And there's other. Rory Darge, I think, has actually had a very, very good tournament when he's featured for Scotland as well. There's just a nice feeling around them as a side, and sort of a sense that maybe this is it. Maybe they are kind of legit title contenders. It's going to be really interesting. Right, let's finish up and get into some of your questions. Okay, thank you as ever for your questions. Much appreciated. Always give us plenty to think about. We've got one to kick off from a friend of the podcast, Guillaume from L'Équipe, who says, during the Rugby World Cup, Steve Borthwick thought Marcus Smith was not able to play fly half. 3 months later, his opinion has changed. And so that's kind of referencing the way that England used Smith as a fullback and as a secondary playmaker. But Charlie, he's very much a fly half now, isn't he? We've got other fullbacks to quibble over with Furbank and Stewart. He's not going to come back in at fullback, is he?
Yeah, there's not enough room in the fullback debate. A dear friend of the podcast. A few things have changed, right? So Owen Farrell isn't there anymore, for one. And I think the second major factor might have been how Marcus Smith started the season for Harlequins. Lots of measured kicking in that, lots of control of territory as well as bringing his USP is, which is that kind of dancing running threat. He was set up, you know, a lot of people sort of quite close to the squad were telling us how disappointed they were after his calf injury, because it felt like an opportune time for him to really kick on and make that 10 shirt his own. And I know what George Ford brings there is that control, is that experience. And I think that will continue to be quite valuable now that he's started those 3 games. Going right back to how we started this podcast, I agree with Charles that I would be very surprised if Marcus Smith does now start, but I can see that those, I can see Marcus Smith and George Ford dovetailing quite nicely at 10 and 22, just given what how Marcus Smith can sort of spark a game.
I think back to two games this season, just to slightly argue with you, Guillaume, sorry. Harlequins away at Racing and the big game at Twickenham against Gloucester, mainly the one at Racing away, where Marcus Smith played absolutely beautifully, and I thought that was a real sort of key moment in his development and maturity, whereby all of a sudden he was looking at putting others away in holes and creating space for others and not necessarily always having to sort of do everything himself. He kicked brilliantly. I mean, he kicked a long-range drop goal, which is not, you know, it doesn't mean much despite the fact that England have got a bit of a penchant for drop goals. It doesn't mean much, but it embodied and symbolised this sort of maturity and game management of keeping the scoreboard ticking along and doing the right thing. And I was really, really, really impressed with him at that day in La Défense when Quinns, against all odds, defeated Racing. And I do think that he should be given a run. But again, as we've said, and as Charlie's just said, when fit, should he be thrust straight back in? I don't think so. I think I'd prefer to see Finn Smith right now, this week, in terms of the context of the tournament. I think I'd prefer to see Finn Smith start, but certainly for the tour to New Zealand, give Marcus the keys.
So hang on. So you want Finn Smith to start? You want Ford to start? And I would like Marcus Smith to start. So this is why we're not selectors.
It's a Mexican standoff.
Because we're, you know,
no pun intended.
We're all in our own corners.
Clarity and cohesion.
And
lacking.
Well, that ties into our...
it's like a Markley Overmont selection meeting.
Ties into our... that's a great reference. Sorry, also that drop goal, how long range? Are we talking like Fran Steen long range?
No, not quite. I think it was 43 or 45 tops I had. And it was on an artificial surface indoors. So, but even so, it's a good strike.
Wasn't as good as Finn Smith's at Town Park, was it?
Yeah.
No, it wasn't. Because that was an equal long range in what can only be described as biblical...
So
right.
If you'd said that about Finn Smith, you'd have strengthened your Finn Smith argument if you'd twisted that.
We've already mentioned it.
Sorry. Okay. Next question from Elliot. England's attack is a burning hot topic on social media at the moment. And he says, if it's true that England are barely training the attack, as per our Telegraph story, is it not a fundamental question about Steve and his philosophy and his suitability as a head coach? My opinion on this is that England at the moment are a bit like a house that needs a lot of work, and you kind of need to just decide which bit you want to work on first of all. And they've decided that they want to work on the defence first, it seems, based on everything we're hearing and certainly based on everything we're seeing when they actually get on the field. So I think you just have to... I know preaching patience is a fine line when you are spending a lot of money on tickets to go and watch England play. I can absolutely appreciate the frustration and errors like you saw at Murrayfield are inexcusable. But I kind of just think that they're prioritising other things at the moment. And it doesn't necessarily reflect on Wigglesworth as an attack coach because attack isn't the focus. Charlie, what do you think?
I think that's really fair. And I think it is... I've said this previously... People are sick of hearing about the excuses, as you say. People are sick of hearing about coaches imploring that they get a bit of time. And I don't think Steve Borthwick is doing that particularly because he knows that people are wary of it. But what he's had to pick up is almost the three separate campaigns in isolation that he's had. And that's off the back of an Eddie Jones era that is still creating, or certainly up to this season with the players that have left, was still Joe Marchant is the big one, right? He agreed to go because he was out of the picture with Eddie Jones. So that's the context. The context is really difficult for him. And you're right, they have to do this gradually just because of logistics and having the training time available to them. It makes sense that with a new defence coach, that is what they're going to want to prioritise straight away in areas of their game. And I've written about this for this morning, is a skill for, I think, a lot of facets of his coaching will be under the microscope this week, not just selection, but also how he instills confidence that areas of that Scotland performance were actually all right. They were good in the air. They were decent at the set piece. They scored a really nice first phase try. They've got to build on that and then also improved the areas that let them down, which was that just that tidiness around the breakdown and the handling errors, which were horrible. But yeah, they've got to prioritise something, as you're right.
I think his track record suggests that it is worth keeping the faith as well. I mean, at Leicester, I know sort of, you know, it's quite revisionist, but people have sort of tarred them with a quite boring conservative brush. But if you go back and actually watch some of Leicester's big victories, it's not true. They attacked very well, but in the 22, they were very ruthless. They were very direct, and they attacked very well in the sort of in the opposition half when they smelt blood. But it was the kick chase, and there was lots of kicking and conservatism that got them there with Leicester, and they did kick a lot from deep. They didn't take any risks in their own half. They didn't play out of their own 22. No, and there wasn't much counter-attacking. But once they got to the 22, Leicester attacked very, very well and scored some very, very tidy, pretty tries. And I think that will surely be his vision for how he wants England to attack. But at the minute, they are not good in the 22, and that's something that really needs to improve, and something that he will be working on is how they improve this, that clinical edge, that ruthlessness in the opposition 22, because England weren't good in the 22 under Eddie Jones, and they haven't been so good under Steve Borthwick either, and that's a real work on for them. But evidence suggests from his time at Leicester that it might and hopefully will, for his sake, come. But it's not an overnight fix.
The best I've seen this termed, and I'm really sorry, I've forgotten who actually said it, but it was, if you're an England fan tuning in and you're seeing Elliot Daly, you're seeing George Ford, you're seeing Joe Marler, Dan Cole, Jamie George, Henry Slade, these guys that are really experienced, it's harder to forgive muddled performances because of this. And then in this contrast with Wales, kind of wiping the slate clean comes to the forefront again. If you're a Wales fan, you're forgiving, you know, that little bit of uncertainty, and you actually haven't seen that much uncertainty from Wales, because they've looked dogged, and they've looked kind of quite dynamic, even though they've gone down to these defeats. So that's again part of this big messy catch 22 that Steve Borthwick's facing.
And our final question from Chattering Reserve is almost a logistical question for the Telegraph, where he says, at least one of you will be in France on Super Saturday. So is anyone going to be at the Rugby Europe Championship finals on the Sunday? Logistically, we can't make it work because of various flights and travel. But that's going to be very good, isn't it, Charles? Sort of having that kind of event on that day. There's so much interest in those teams now after the Rugby World Cup.
Yeah, I mean, pre-tournament, when we were looking at travel and itineraries and this and the other, I noticed that it was in Paris, and we did look at going. The issue was pre-tournament that we thought that it could be, well, there was a chance it could have been a Grand Slam decider, because a lot of us had France as favourites and the Grand Slam champions, and there was a chance that England might be going to Lyon to thwart the Grand Slam, or even, you know, in the wildest dreams, that England would be going to,
I was gonna say, to Lyon a Grand Slam decider for themselves. France might win the Grand Slam.
Yes, France might win the Grand Slam. But even in the wildest dreams, there might have been that England were going to France for a Grand Slam of their own, and then Sunday becomes incredibly busy for us. So no, we won't be there in person, but we will certainly be watching, and hopefully on that Monday morning podcast, which will be the last one of this series, we will have a short discussion about the victor, which is shaping up to be a cracking game. There's three finals that day. It's sort of staged, and if you were a betting man, you'd say that the big grand finale in the evening would be Georgia against either Portugal or Spain.
Yeah, fun. No, we'll definitely have a chat about it. Right, that's it for today. Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Charles. Quick predictions for the three games. Charles, start with you.
Italy, Ireland, France.
3-1 score games.
One score games, lovely. Yeah.
Scotland, Ireland, Wales.
Oh, yeah, Yeah, I'm thinking the same.
I agree with 3-1 score games as well. I think they'll all be close.
For variety, I'll say Scotland, Ireland and France. Winner.
You didn't want to say England for variety?
No. Winner gets a pack of Werther's Originals next week or something.
Superb.
Thank you, Charlie. Thank you, Charles. Thank you, everybody, for listening to the podcast, for downloading it, for subscribing. Loads of build-up this week to the big games, especially that England-Ireland game at Twickenham. Could be an absolutely fascinating 80 minutes. We'll all be back next week to review, to look ahead to the final round of action in the Six Nations. But for now, goodbye.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.